Good afternoon, everyone. It's a great pleasure to start my term as co-chair of the New York chapter with a fantastic program, and Matthew Moore and I, my co-chair, and I are pleased to welcome you today. And I would like to quickly introduce our speaker for today, Katie Lachter, who is a partner at Hinshaw & Culbertson. She's a member of the firm's National Lawyers for the Profession Practice Group. Katie focuses her practice on attorney professional responsibility and risk management. She is a lecturer in law at Columbia Law School, where she teaches professional responsibility. She's also a member of the City Bar Association's Committee on Professional Ethics and is a frequent writer and speaker on issues relating to legal ethics. Katie was selected as a 2014 Rising Star by Super Lawyers, no surprise, and is a 2012 recipient of the Burton Award for Distinguished Legal Writing. She's a graduate of Harvard Law School, cum laude, and Dartmouth College, summa cum laude. Please welcome Katie Lachter.
First of all, I want to say thank you for having me. Back before I decided which way I wanted to go in practice, I actually wanted to be an IP lawyer. So my property professor in law school very kindly told me that, you know, there's the property side of intellectual property, and I maybe wasn't so into that part. But I'm really excited to be here. I love teaching ethics. As Eleanor said, I teach at Columbia Law. And while it's really nice to teach law students, I also enjoy, you know, being with groups of sophisticated practitioners who can get into the really hard issues and the gray areas and have a good debate on it. So I welcome questions and comments and insights at any point during the program, and I also will reserve at least 10 minutes at the end to take your questions. So I wish I were responsible for this really clever title, but credit for that goes to Eleanor, Separating Rights from Wrongs, The Ethics of Enforcement. And I was just speaking with Matthew, and I actually I realized, because this is a copyright-focused group, the examples that I tend to use in my ethics IP programs are from trademark, but the ethics principles are transferable. And if at any point you think that, you know, there's a particular issue that's specific to copyright that I'm not addressing, feel free to let me know, and we can talk about it in the copyright context. But this concept of bullying is one that's gotten a lot of attention in recent years as lawyers try to navigate, you know, how aggressively they can pursue their clients' rights. And so there are different definitions that you'll find out there, but the one that I tend to use would be overly aggressive tactics used, you know, by a trademark or a copyright owner to enforce rights beyond the scope of what they're actually legally entitled to. And the typical scenario would be a large entity that has pretty significant legal and economic resources going up against an individual or a small entity that it thinks is going to be likely to capitulate quickly because that entity doesn't have the resolve or the money to go the distance in litigation and may not want to get into it at all. One of the favorite tools of the IP bully is the cease and desist letter, a letter that, you know, asserts the owner's rights, generally in a very broad fashion, and then lists some parade of horribles that might happen if the, you know, the recipient of the letter doesn't immediately stop infringing. Now, I don't mean to suggest that there's anything inherently wrong with a cease and desist letter. You've probably all used them many, many times. They're used by virtually all trademark and copyright owners to legitimately enforce rights, and that's fine. None of the things that I'm going to talk about apply to legitimate use. But the letters cross the line when they assert rights or suggest remedies that are beyond the scope of legal protection. And I say that specifically, use an egregious or threatening tone. And we'll come back to that a little bit later and talk about some specifics. But, you know, the question is, how aggressive is too aggressive? And there's a lot of different ways to look at it, but that's a question that's not really easily answered. And so it's one of the things that, one of the themes that I want to come back to today in order to sort of help you figure out how to navigate. So there are a lot of different mechanisms that are currently in place that are designed to prevent lawyers from engaging in unreasonably aggressive tactics. The commentary on these tends to focus on the fact that they're not particularly useful for the pre-litigation stage because most of them apply after the point at which a suit is already instituted. So if you can't get a Rule 11 sanction unless you're in federal court. And so at the demand letter stage, it's sort of the Wild West. The aim of a copyright bully would be to get somebody to fold in the very early stages prior to litigation. So these things are not particularly helpful. The other problem is that these mechanisms themselves have a lot of inherent limitation to them. Rule 11 sanctions, for example, standard is really high. It's a standard of objective unreasonableness in whatever it is that you're asserting on behalf of your client. Meanwhile, likelihood of confusion is a very murky standard. And so what you see is that these sanctions are pretty often denied in IP cases. For example, in the Southern District in 2008, court specifically found that infringement claims lacked a legal and factual basis, and also in the same breath found that that assertion of the plaintiff's claim was not sanctionable. The reason being, at that early stage of litigation, the idea is not that you have to be able to prove your claim, it's whether you know there will be evidentiary support for one of the claims later on. And so it's essentially, this is just too early to make that determination. And so if courts are saying that about the early stages of litigation, then it logically follows that the pre-litigation stage, you're not going to have much luck. Declaratory judgment is a useful tool that a recipient of a cease and desist could use if served with one. The only requirement is that there be a justiciable controversy, and courts have held that letters that don't even overtly threaten litigation but just say, you're infringing, watch out, are enough to establish a justiciable controversy. Problem, of course, is that you have to go into federal court and institute a proceeding, and a lot of these, recipients that fall on the David side of the David and Goliath scale might not have the resources or the wherewithal to go into federal court. Interesting thing that's come up in the domain name context is this concept of reverse domain name hijacking. So under the Uniform Dispute Resolution Policy, if a domain name complaint is brought in bad faith, you can be tagged for reverse domain name hijacking. Problem? There's no penalty. So this is not a rule or a policy that has particular teeth. This is, for acts that are brought under, arbitrations. You can have effects later on where the arbitrators might find that you've engaged in abusive tactics before, and so it may sway their decisions in later cases. But I think it's fairly toothless as far as a mechanism for prevention goes. And the same with the Uniform Rapid Suspension provision for abusive complaints. It's a little bit better. If you do it twice, then you can be prevented from filing another complaint. But people can still get away with doing it once and really causing a lot of harm to someone. And then I just wanted to point out, just by way of comparison, because this applies across fields of law. In the UK, things are done a lot differently, and sanctions proceedings look a lot different. Now, if you make a groundless threat in the UK, you can actually get tagged with paying the other side's fees. In the U.S., if you bring a case and you lose, it loser pays. In the U.K., you can't get away with that. A lot of people and a lot of my ethics colleagues think that that's too restrictive a regime, and I'd be interested to hear what people think about that. But it is a way of preventing frivolous conduct that we don't have here. And finally, the last example, I call it angry judges. In a litigation proceeding, you could get lucky, and you could find a judge that is not happy with overly aggressive tactics, and will actually sua sponte sanction an attorney. There's a superior court judge in LA who got angry about an attorney's threatening letters that he was sending to the other side, and actually made a finding on the record that those letters constituted extortion as a matter of law. Because he said the other side, the attorney who sent the letter, this is not in an IP context, it's actually in an entertainment not IP-related context, attorney who sent the letter was trying to shame and degrade the other side and to get money for it. And the court said, no way, that's extortion. But that's pretty rare. Question back there?
On the reverse domain name hijacking, even if there isn't a penalty, couldn't the aggrieved party use that and go to your bar officials and say that you engaged in unethical conduct or improper conduct as a result of that and look for them to impose a penalty? And could they use that as a hook, or could they not use that as a hook?
So that's a great question. The standards are different in disciplinary proceedings than they are in civil proceedings, and particularly when you're talking alternative dispute resolution, that whatever standard that the board is using is, it's going to be probably of their own making, right? So it's certainly not going to be a one-to-one comparison. You can't say that you've done something unethical simply because this particular board made a finding. And we're going to talk a little bit about the model rules of professional conduct and the different states' takes on them and what you actually need to do to prove a disciplinary violation. But I would certainly think it would be an important piece of evidence, a finding by some adjudicatory authority that someone did something, frivolous, very likely to at least get, raise the hackles of the disciplinary authorities. In order for them to find out about it, particularly in an ADR context, somebody would have to refer that lawyer to the correct state disciplinary authority, which is something that people are starting to do more and more, even though it doesn't confer civil benefit on them. The only remedy there is discipline of the lawyer. But if someone is particularly aggrieved by what a lawyer is doing, that's definitely a possibility. So, and that's actually a perfect segue into the framework that I want to put on all of this is we do have ethical rules, and how can we work within the rules that we do have to prevent these overly aggressive tactics, and do they really work? Is the big question. The rules of professional conduct in the different states and before the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office provide some protection. Like I mentioned earlier, the protections are enforced through discipline of lawyers. But what's nice about these is that the rules govern attorneys in all aspects of their practice, not just in litigation, even though some of the rules specifically pertain to litigation. So in a way, that already gives us a leg up on some of the other mechanisms that we talked about. And you're probably all familiar, but just because we're giving out ethics credits here, The rules of professional conduct in all of the states except California are now modeled on the ABA model rules of professional conduct. Some states have adopted the model rules almost verbatim from the ABA's template. Most have made some changes to them, but at least follow the same rules format. So you can look at, for example, rule 3.1 in almost any state and see that has to do with filing frivolous claims. The only outlier state would be California, which doesn't even follow the model rules format, and it's impossible to do any ethics research there, and you really need a California lawyer. So what I'm going to do, because we're New York lawyers, I'm going to talk about the New York rules, but where there are significant differences from the model rules, I'll point them out just for point of reference, and because a lot of states do tend to follow the model rules format. And I will try not to belabor this part so we can get to the more fun stuff. So I think the most important thing to keep in mind is obviously an attorney who's writing a fraudulent demand letter can be disciplined for that. It's not okay to do that. In New York, the term fraud or fraudulent refers to conduct that's fraudulent under the state's substantive or procedural law or has a purpose to deceive. And then it specifically accepts conduct that lacks scienter, scienter being defined as deceit, intent to mislead, or knowing failure to correct a misrepresentation. So in New York, we have a high standard. If you want to show that somebody, fraudulently violated one of the rules of professional conduct, you have to show that they had an intent to do it. The model rule is a little bit more lax. In model rule jurisdictions, the conduct has to be fraudulent under the law of the jurisdiction or have a purpose to deceive, but that's it. No specific scienter requirement, although the comment says that this rule does not include negligent misrepresentation. So I take that to mean that there's some area between just a negligent misrepresentation and an outright falsehood that you know, in the model rule state, you may have violated the rule even without getting to the point of scienter, which you would need in New York. The reason that I bring this up is because even in states following the more lenient standard, you know, under which a lawyer can be more easily disciplined, that lawyer, if he's admitted in New York or in a state that follows the higher standard, can still be disciplined because New York will impose reciprocal discipline in most cases. And they tend to follow both the charge and the penalty that are applied in the other states. So, for example, model rule states such as Missouri on this rule, lawyer violates the rule there, even though the lawyer might not have been found to violate the rule had he been working in New York. If he gets disciplined in Missouri and he's admitted here, he can be reciprocally disciplined here. It's a little tool that the disciplinary committees tend to like to use against my clients that I'm not particularly fond of, particularly when they don't tell me right away that they've been disciplined in other states before we get going on the proceeding, which happens from time to time. And the other thing I want to point out is just that that the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, you also have to show harm to the recipient as a result of the misrepresentation. So the USPTO now follows the model rules, but that's a slightly different standard. Okay. So this rule is one of my favorite and least favorite. It's one of my least favorite because whoever was drafting it seems to think circular reasoning is wonderful. So diligence is defined as acting diligently. Without any sort of explanation of what that really means. So this rule says, you know, a lawyer shall act with reasonable diligence and promptness in representing a client. The comment one to the model rule is interesting because it talks about zealous advocacy, which is a watchword that lawyers have liked to glom onto for years. You have to work for your client's benefit with zeal and advocacy on the client's behalf. And the model rule says, you know, however, this does not require that you use offensive tactics. Glad that they clarified that. New York takes a different approach to this purposely. So when the drafters were looking at these rules, the old Code of Professional Responsibility had the zealous advocacy point embedded in it. New York specifically got rid of that because they don't like the fact that lawyers use it to justify, you know, overly aggressive tactics. The New York rule says the lawyer need not press for every advantage on behalf of a client and that the lawyer should not use offensive tactics. Markedly different from the model rule, and it's designed to prevent the kind of behavior that we're talking about. So New York sees a particular problem with aggressive litigation. Of course, this rule leaves open, I think, all of the major questions that you might have. What does diligence mean? Is it the same as doing due diligence? And how much can you rely on what your client tells you? So we'll come back to all of those questions, you know, in specific contexts, but something we're thinking about. Rule 3.1 is also it's also relevant here. It's the prohibition against asserting a frivolous claim. And the comment to the rule in New York and the model rule makes clear that conduct is not frivolous, you know, even though the lawyer thinks that the client's position ultimately isn't going to prevail. The standard is not that high. But if it lacks merit in fact and law, and the lawyer knows that, then he can't institute such a claim. So this rule is not specifically designed to deal with things like demand letters, you know, pre-litigation conduct. This applies to formal proceedings. But if an attorney writes a demand letter that he knows is utterly meritless, he might have violated other rules, such as the ones we're going to talk about. And I think this one should, at the very least, inform that kind of conduct, because you're heading, once you say, I'm going to do X, you know, if you don't do Y, you're heading in the direction of having to do X in order to stand your ground and not look foolish, and you don't want X to be over the line. This rule also brings to light the problem of belief versus knowledge. Knowledge in the rules is defined as actual knowledge, not constructive, not, you know, not anything else. Actual knowledge, but it doesn't say, again, helpfully, what that knowledge actually means. Do you need 100% knowledge? Do you need a really reasonable belief? You can infer it from circumstances, but that might not be enough to tell you exactly where you are. So if a lawyer knows that his client's position is completely without merit in fact or law, that's a problem. The lawyer believes the client's position is pretty weak, but there's some basis for proceeding, then that's okay. And the rules, I think, they make sense in the abstract, and then when you try to apply them, they can be mind-bending. Rule 4.1 applies directly to the topic of demand letters or cease and desist letter. This rule, the model rule, prohibits a lawyer from making a false statement of material fact or law to a third person. The New York rule is slightly different, puts that scienter requirement in there, prohibits a lawyer from knowingly making a false statement of fact or law to a third person. This is should be directly available as deterrence to copyright bullying or trademark bullying. But again, the only consequence to it would be disciplinary for the lawyer, so someone would have to institute a disciplinary action to get anything out of that. Hopefully lawyers, especially now that they're forced to take all the CLE, lawyers are hearing about these rules and thinking about them in ways that maybe they didn't before and are changing their behavior accordingly. Almost done with the rule section. Rule 4.4 comes into play here too. This is the rule that says under the model rule and in New York that a lawyer shouldn't use means that, or shall not use means that have no substantial purpose other than to embarrass or harm a third person. And I think this dovetails, I mean, I read it this way, other people may disagree, but I think it dovetails with the rules about diligence and about instituting frivolous proceedings. Because if you know that your client has a meritless claim and you're threatening another party, then it seems to me there's an argument that what you're doing has no purpose other than to cause harm. And if you're dealing with an alleged infringer, this is also just a warning that there's no value in embarrassing the other side. You can try to get them to stop what they're doing without causing them, you know, undue embarrassment. And then the final rule I want to talk about is Rule 8.4. This is the general prohibition against misconduct. And it's a catch-all rule. It's got like a million and one sections. This is the rule that forbids the fraudulent conduct that's defined in the terminology rule. It forbids conduct that's illegal and reflects adversely on the lawyer's fitness to practice. Forbids conduct prejudicial to the administration of justice, again, without defining what that is. Makes it misconduct to assist a judge in any kind of conduct that would violate their code of judicial conduct. And it used to be the case, but is not anymore, from what I'm seeing, that a single violation of one of the subsections of Rule 8.4 on its own, without any other rule violation, was usually not enough to get you disciplined. But now I'm seeing a disturbing trend in the disciplinary committees, mostly in Manhattan and in Brooklyn. I don't know so much about the third and fourth departments. But in the first and second, I'm seeing clients getting disciplined for one single act that can only be fit into the rules of professional conduct by way of one of the subsections of Rule 8.4. So this is something to think about. It's something to watch out for. It's not pattern in practice anymore. Quickly, a couple of other ethical considerations. Until very recently, the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office was behind the times, and they continued to rely on the old model code of professional responsibility, and not even the most up-to-date version. They were relying on the 1980 version. I only bring this up because the USPTO still relies on its own ethics opinions, and some of these opinions, most in fact, are probably still good law. So they're still good guidance because a lot of the rules, even though they changed at the margins, didn't change the real ethical principles behind them. But when you're doing ethics research, it's something to watch out for. Watch whether you're seeing provisions that start DR or rule, because if they're talking about DRs, that's under the old model code, and it may or may not hold up anymore. And then finally, I bring up this ethics opinion, which is, it's an older opinion, it's from 1973, but it's interesting because it specifically said that it was misconduct for a lawyer to write a letter threatening to file suit when the lawyer in fact knew that the client was not planning to file suit. And the way they, which maybe it should be obvious, but there's a lot of debate about this opinion. The hook they used is that it's fraud to knowingly make a false statement of fact. And when I'm on the City Bar Ethics Committee, and when we debate this topic, people say all the time, but what about like puffing in negotiations? I mean, you can't say, if we can't come to some agreement here, you know, I'm going to sue you, even if you have no real intention of suing. I mean, what if there's a 0.001% chance that if you can't settle the thing, then you might go to litigation? And it has been deemed okay, not by any specific rule provision, but by ethics opinions from different state bars, that that puffing, as they've defined it, does not violate the rules. So if I say my bottom line is $500,000 and I'm not going $1 beneath that, it's not reasonable to rely on that statement, is what the ethics opinions say, because it is probably so likely to be false. Or I might change my mind the next second. So that's what they mean by puffing. But I think this really falls kind of in the same area. You know, you can't write a letter saying I'm going to sue you if you absolutely know your client's not going to sue. So that's something to think about, and something that surprised me when I first started doing these programs. The only other rule I want to mention, there is a rule in New York that says a lawyer can't threaten criminal prosecution for the sole purpose of obtaining an advantage in a civil litigation. And this is relevant because of the criminalization of counterfeiting and other things. You don't want to be threatening criminal prosecution if the person doesn't cave in when you want them to in a civil proceeding. Okay. So now here's where my examples tend to... Oh, sorry, another question.
Just a quick question, but on that point,
yes.
Can't you inform the person you're writing a letter to that their conduct is violating? Well, like, you know, in addition... We also inform you that your conduct violates the following criminal statutes for the following reasons. Have a nice day.
I think that's okay. I think the way the rule is actually worded, I think it says you can't present criminal charges for the sole purpose of gaining advantage in a civil litigation. Query what presenting means. In practice, it's interpreted as threatening. You can't threaten someone with criminal prosecution. There's an argument on either side with that one. I mean, somebody could say the mere fact of mentioning a criminal statute in what's otherwise a letter pertaining only to a civil proceeding can only be interpreted as a threat. Now, I don't think the regulators would find that, but like I say to my clients, do you want to be the test case? And the answer is usually no, and I can usually, you know, the more conservative advice would be stay away from, you know, talking about criminal activity in the context of trying to get something going in the civil litigation. A letter, you know, if the litigation's over or, you know, maybe not even at a point where it's being hotly contested, to send a letter just saying, hey, we think your behavior violates X, Y, and Z, that probably okay. So it's pretty contextually dependent. Yeah?
Well, when you say threatening criminal
Usually what the lawyers who want to threaten criminal prosecution will do is say, you know, I'm leaving my office right now and I'm going directly to the Bronx County DA's office. And, you know, and the ones who like to be even more egregious about it say, I have friends there, you know, I went to law school with half their incoming class and, you know, they're going to listen to me, that kind of thing. I've seen pretty much every which way of doing this that you can imagine. The really conservative position, which is I'm not necessarily recommending, stay away from criminal conduct at all in terms of potential threats or presentation or whatever. So I gave you for today's program some materials, and I tried to pick the ones that I thought were the most entertaining. Mostly they come from Above the Law, which is where I found some of these letters, and they're examples of cease and desist letters. And again, I apologize for the trademark focus, but that seems to be, at least on the internet, where a lot of the concern is in this area. So the first one is that Starbucks got all up in arms because a small brewery in Missouri started selling a beer that the bar itself didn't actually name it anything, but some customers of the bar started referring to it as the Frappuccino beer. And they started posting in online forums, and they spelled Frappuccino wrong. So Starbucks, you know, corporate counsel, sends this letter, this scathing letter to the owner of the pub that's saying, you know, you're infringing on our mark and you better stop right away. There, you know, people are going to be confused and think we're in some way affiliated with this. And so you're not allowed to use Frappuccino or anything phonetically similar. And this owner, the pub owner, wrote a letter back, which I included in the materials, that I thought was just brilliant. And he basically said, you know what, you're right. Like, people coming into my bar and ordering a vanilla beer might actually think they're in Starbucks, and I can't believe I caused that state of affairs. And, you know, here's a $6 check for the two beers that I sold using this name. And he actually sent the check, which is the part that I think it just makes him so respectable. And so my question is, you know, is this bullying? Is this a real concern on Starbucks' part? Or is that, you know, what you have to do to protect your mark, because, you know, the way the law is worded, if you don't protect it, you could lose rights. So I'm curious, because this is a group that will know, who thinks this is, you know, unfair bullying? Seriously? I'm like, wait, not loud. Okay, good. Why do you think it's unfair?
I just think it's ridiculous. It's a David and Goliath problem. And I think that the lawyer who did that would feel ridiculous if he thought about it. I mean, and it's such bad PR. And that's something you also have to think about. It totally backfires on the company. They look like
Jewish. Yeah, and we're going to talk about that in a little bit. Internet shaming has actually become one of the most useful ways to fight back against this problem. But this is great. I'm actually really surprised. There's only a handful who think this is bullying. So most of you, I presume, think that Starbucks doesn't really have a choice here, because they do have a valuable mark that they have to protect. And if they don't assert their rights as broadly as possible, they run the risk of losing them. Is that about, yeah?
I was going to say that I think you're right about that. You got to worry about that. But in this case, a nicer letter might have been the way to do it. You know, and you clearly don't know that, you don't realize that this is a protected mark, and you sold it for years, you really shouldn't do it. And then, if they keep doing it for a year or two, then you send a CMB, you know, I don't know. But
yeah,
to threaten them out of the box for something that seems a little bit far afield from coffee.
Tell me questions were there about this. I mean, why did it come to Starbucks' attention in the first place?
Oh, tons and tons and tons and tons of people got wind of this. Because once somebody posts it and then, you know, links to it, other blogs start getting it. There's tweets about it. There's forums about it. And because this has become a real hot button issue, there are actually, and I'll show you some examples, there are forums devoted solely to, you know, shaming companies that send nasty cease and desist letters that people think are too broadly disseminated. So, but I think the sending of the nice letter first is something that a lot of lawyers don't think about, but to me that would be the perfect thing to do. And then it wouldn't get the same kind of negative publicity. There's actually an example where someone, I think it was a champagne company, made a label for one of its bottles based on a Jack Daniel's whiskey label, and it really did clearly look like the Jack Daniel's label, and it seems like it might be confusing. And Jack Daniel's wrote what can only be described as like the nicest cease and desist letter in the history of all mankind, and they actually got tremendous credit for it. The internet trolls, for lack of a better word, you know, the people who troll around on the internet and complain about these bullying tactics, cite to Jack Daniel's as an example of how you can do this without, you know, causing the uproar right away. So the Jack Daniel's letter, pretty much along the lines of, you know, what your colleague just said, you know, you may not realize that, you know, this looks an awful lot like our label. Here's an example of what our label looks like. Here's an example of what yours looks like. Here's where we think people might get confused, you know. Please stop doing this. Sincerely, love, Jack Daniel's. And it just went over a lot better than these missives. Another favorite example of mine is that Hanes Brands took it upon themselves to go after this Canadian hummus maker, like literally this guy who's in his garage like mashing up chickpeas, and it's called Hanes Hummus. And I mean, the idea that people might confuse hummus with underwear is one that I haven't been able to figure out. And this lends to a lot of really funny hummus underwear jokes too, which is why I like to talk about it. But this is another one that got people on the internet just, you know, going crazy, because, you know, obviously there's a small problem meeting the likelihood of confusion test. But Hanes Brands is like still going strong here. Like they have not been shamed enough, because the like poor Hanes hummus people in Canada are still trying to deal with them. And then finally, the last one. This one I thought was interesting because it just had political undertones to it. There's a local resident in West Orange, New Jersey, who's very outspoken, very liberal, comes out against a lot of what his local legislators are doing. And he has a discussion forum on the web. It's powered by this company called Simple Machines, and it's, you know, a very pretty simple and straightforward forum, and it was called, I think it was like westorangeinfo.com or something like that, and he gets this letter from the town attorney for the town of West Orange, New Jersey, that says, you know, you're trying to confuse people and make people think that this is real, legitimate information coming from our government, and it's obviously not, and, you know, so on and so forth, stop or you'll be executed publicly in the square. And so he fought back the way people who have internet forums do. He posted a response on his forum that got a lot of hits, and he actually got a letter named Jake Freiwald to write it for him. And the letter is, it's an example of some really good legal wit backed up by some really good legal argument. And they, you know, the first letter says, like, thank you so much for this joke, because that's all this could possibly be. And then it lists like 25 websites that also look confusingly similar to like westorangeinfo.com and say, you know, you must be shutting all of these other people down too. And then it says, you know, if this weren't a joke, which it must be, this is what the response would say. And it lists the real response. And this, again, has caused a lot of uproar. And as far as I know, most of these cases haven't actually, or they're not really cases, most of these matters haven't actually gone anywhere. So the pub was never serving a Frappuccino beer to begin with. So they're not serving, you know, they're not serving that particular style anymore. I think this poor hummus guy is still trying to, like, make hummus. And, you know, the West Orange guy is still running his forum. It's still up. So nothing's actually come of any of this. So you have to wonder whether the, you know, the public scorn and ridicule is worth it. And so, you know, the next question, I think, has to be, well, is there anything we can do? Oh, yeah?
I think what you learn from this is today, any cease and desist letter you write conceivably can end up on the internet. Or something you never saw before. But any little party has such power to get public sympathy, and you really have to say to yourself, will this letter, if exposed widely, hurt my clients? Lawyers don't really look at it that way. But there can be very negative effects. And I've even seen a case where some little party got such a letter, and he started a blog asking for money to defend his case, and he got a couple of $1,000. So it's just amazing how this is all publicly exposed these days.
I think that's a great point. I mean, one of the things that I do now in my my law school ethics classes, we're really short on classes. There's only 10 classes in the semester, but I devote an entire 2-hour class to online activity and, you know, how things are different than they were when the rules were written. You know, for example, a lot of clients are waiving their privilege without even thinking about it, right? You post a, I mean, these letters, they're going to the other side, so they're not privileged, but sometimes you see people posting memoranda from their lawyers, you see all sorts of stuff. You know, as lawyers, we have an obligation to know that our clients may take to the internet when we're not looking, when we're not thinking about it, and advise them accordingly. Similarly, once they do put something up on the internet, you know, you can't just tell them, oh, that was a bad idea, take that down, because then you might be spoliating evidence. So there's lots of things to think about on, you know, both sides of that coin. Yeah?
If Frappuccino was a registered famous mark, would you recommend to the client just to assert in the letter a dilution claim and stay away from likelihood of confusion? Would that be very safe way to proceed?
I think you know more about me than the substantive law here, but I think if there is an actual likelihood of confusion, it's better to spell out what it is. So in the bar case, the issue is not that someone's going to walk into a bar and think that they're in Starbucks. They may have this drink and think that somehow Starbucks has partnered up with, you know, local breweries to offer this. And I can see that that's not totally far-fetched. So I think if you're going to make a likelihood of confusion claim, does it pass the laugh test, right? Can you make it with a straight face? And if you can, spell it out a little bit, so then at least you're shielded from, you know, the argument that you're just making some, like, crazy, ridiculous claim.
Well, dilution doesn't require likelihood of confusion. It just means you take a famous registered mark and you use it in a way that's going to weaken it in some way, which, on my hypothetical, revising your hypothetical, seems that's a straight-ahead claim, whereas likelihood of confusion doesn't really pass the sort of common sense thing, so you just go with the dilution.
Yeah. I mean, I think if you're not running the risk of losing important rights by not asserting the claim, then I see no reason not to proceed that way. I also think there's a way to validly proceed on a likelihood of confusion claim. You just have to be a little bit more careful about it. I'm not even saying Starbucks would lose if it made it into court, but this was never going to court. We weren't going to court over a local brewery serving a few beers. So I think maybe they just need to rethink their tactics a little bit so they don't come off looking like this corporate behemoth that's trying to like crush craft beer. A lot of people really like craft beer, and they get up in arms about this stuff. Yeah, question?
Regarding your spoliation comment, right, you'll send a cease and desist letter a lot of times, you know, notifying them of, you know, infringing material that's up on the web. And the first thing that they'll do, you know, sometimes after having consulted with their attorney, is yank it and say, here, in good faith, we're pulling this, right? And say that's not the end of the matter, and then it does go to court proceedings of, you know, some kind. Are they on the hook for potential spoliation, and what are the possible, like, consequences for them for that?
I mean, if there's no litigation in mind, and all you've done is send them a letter saying, you know what, we noticed that you're infringing, you should take this down, I think taking it down is probably the prudent thing to do. Spoliation comes into play more when you've got a real threat of a lawsuit. Like any time that you might feel like you would need to issue a litigation hold, that's the same time period that I would say, if you've got stuff that's up on the internet, you at least want to capture screenshots of it before taking it down. And I assume that the lawyer on the other side likely took a screenshot, you know, or has some evidence of the infringing behavior. I mean, it really is hard to get rid of things on the internet, but you don't want to get, you know, hit with any potential spoliation claims. So it really depends on the stage of the proceeding and what you want the person on the other side to do. If you don't really want to go after them at all and you really just want them to take it down and stop infringing the mark, then, you know what, no problem with saying, hey, take this down. So I won't spend too long, so we're almost out of time. There was proposed legislation in Minnesota that I thought was interesting. A representative there had proposed a bill in 2013 that would require demand letters to Minnesota recipients to include a provision that notified the recipient that either party could request arbitration through a state regulatory agency. And then if either party did request arbitration of the matter, the ALJ would be empowered to make a determination as to whether there was bullying involved. And then if a court affirmed that finding, there could be treble damages. Another provision, which I thought was pretty intense, said that if you're found to have engaged in bullying tactics twice in 10 years, the state can revoke your right to do business in Minnesota. Now, predictably, this legislation went too far and it failed. I mean, the bill just died in the Minnesota legislature. But it was interesting, and that representative is back again with a new bill. This one's not aimed at the demand letter stage, but it's talking about a little bit further on in the proceedings. And there was the chance for a while of potential federal legislation. The U.S. Patent and Trademark Office was actually undertaking a study on the effects of bullying, and they were looking at the demand letter stage, but they concluded that education, not regulation, was the way to go. I can't say that I, you know, can argue with that, because the other side of this is what we were just talking about, this self-help, you know, in the form of shaming. And this is something that people can do with or without lawyers, but I would like to think that they'll be more effective if they're, you know, following the advice of good counsel. One thing to watch out for, though, is going too far in the other direction. So there is this website that I'm familiar with because I'm involved in a matter that relates to it. But the website's called extortionletterinfo.com. It's specifically, I don't know if anyone's familiar with this at all, it's worth checking out, it's really interesting. It's specifically directed toward Getty Images on the theory that the lawyers for Getty Images in Seattle are sending out cease and desist letters all the time to individuals, you know, all across the country that are way too broad, that are too threatening, and that make people feel like, oh my God, I better stop using that like picture of a spider on my blog, or like I'm gonna die or go to jail. So what may actually have been a pretty decent idea in its inception has now turned into, I think, a really big problem. First of all, this site is run by a lawyer and a non-lawyer together. the site, there are fees associated with the site. There's a PayPal request right on the front page asking for donations. It implicates the rule on sharing fees with a non-lawyer if this lawyer and non-lawyer are both, you know, getting fees from the site. It encourages people to file disciplinary complaints against any lawyer that sends them a cease and desist letter, which also, you know, seems frivolous. There's a problem with them engaging in the unauthorized practice of law because this non-lawyer is doing what really appears to be giving out legal advice via the internet to anyone who comes on this site. And actually, he was convicted of stalking one of the posters on the site a while back, and so he disappeared from the site for about 10 months, and now he's back with a vengeance, claiming that, you know, he was wrongfully convicted, and, you know, they're not doing anything wrong here. But what's really sort of outrageous about this site is that there's comment functions. And whoever, they both claim that they're not administering the site, but whoever is administering the site doesn't seem to do any policing of what the comments are. And so there have been some really just vulgar, memes and comments and manipulation of photographs, which, you know, is ironic given that it's Getty Images. But what they actually did was they took the headshot of one of Getty's lawyers off of his website, and somebody then, you know, put Satan ears and, you know, all sorts of things that range from, you know, kind of funny to really disgusting onto his picture and then posted them on the web. And so he responded by sending this website a cease and desist letter telling them not to use his photograph. And so then they've been posting, and I'm watching this every day, they've now been posting on their website their responses, and this is just another example of Getty's, you know, crazy corporate greed that their lawyer is doing this. And it's turned into a war between the lawyers. And it's, you know, it's gotten some attention. So this is an example of where, you know, fighting back for the little guy can actually go bad. So in the 10 minutes that we have left, I want to make sure that I address the things that are on your mind. So if people have questions on this or on any other ethics topic, I am willing to take a shot at answering them. If not, I have a hypothetical that I could throw out to you, but I'm sure people have ethics questions. It's free advice. Come on, people call me all day for this stuff. No? No one? All right. Oh, yes, someone.
I realize that the legal rules don't encompass this issue, but what is the perception of, say, your city bar experience, or maybe from the ethics opinions you've read, about the difference between Getty Images, which is a large, well-known stock photo shop, although it doesn't necessarily own every photo that is distributed by it. In fact, a lot of it's under license. So many of those cease and desist letters are being sent on behalf of very, very small graphic artists or photographers.
Sure.
Many of the lawyers in here represent individual artists, individual songwriters, individual musicians. Mm-hmm. How does that impact the reviewing board's opinion about whether a cease and desist letter is bullying when you remove the big guy, little guy aspect of it?
You know,
what was the question, please?
Oh, sure. Let me repeat the question. So the question is, like, an outfit like Getty Images is actually, they don't own all of the images that they have. And a lot of times when they're sending out their cease and desist letters, it's actually on behalf of a much smaller operation pursuant to a licensing agreement. And the question is, you know, how does that, when you take the big guy, little guy thing out of this, you know, how would it impact the regulators? My instinct is that on a case-by-case basis, a disciplinary committee is just going to look at the context of what's said. The big guy, little guy thing would be one factor that the disciplinary prosecutor would use to show, you know, why this is an example of bullying. When you take that out of it, though, I don't think you're off the hook, particularly if, you know, if on behalf of some, you know, small entity, you're using egregious language, threats, you know, anything that seems like it runs afoul of the rules we talked about earlier. So it's a factor, and when you're defending a disciplinary proceeding, you know, you're at a disadvantage. The disciplinary authorities have a lot of power, it's not really clear what standards are used. Sometimes they hold you to the rules of evidence. Sometimes they don't. They have really broad subpoena powers. That's a David and Goliath situation for sure when you're on the defensive end of a disciplinary inquiry. And so as someone who defends lawyers in those proceedings, I want every factor, you know, as much as possible to be on our side. So if we can remove that one, if you can say, look, I actually am not operating on behalf of Starbucks. I'm operating on behalf of, you know, guy making hummus in his garage, then you may be in a little bit of a better position. Anybody else? Yeah.
Can IP owner, can IP owner company hire another company, not a law firm, to operate its cease and desist business and settlement business?
Interesting. Okay, so the question is whether a law firm can hire a...
Not a law firm, an IP owner.
An IP owner. Okay, so we're not talking lawyers at all.
Right. That, we'll have lawyers, but...
Right. IP owner.
The only issue I can see there is whether the cease and desist operations are going to be perceived as the practice of law. I don't know that you can find, maybe you guys may know more than I do, whether these places exist. But if I were owning or working at a company that just sent out cease and desist letters, I'd be concerned that seems in a lot of states, like that seems like something that lawyers do. UPL is really not well defined. Some states, like Florida, for example, California, seem to think, you know, almost any lawyerly type activity done within its borders is unauthorized practice of law. That sometimes, I mean, those rules are, they're not applied very uniformly, but a lot of the states have criminalized that. It's actually a misdemeanor to engage in unauthorized practice. So I would be concerned from that standpoint. Are you familiar with, I mean, are there, there are non-law cease and desist letter businesses out there?
There may be.
I mean, look, it's very hype. Look, everything that's said in here is attorney-client privilege. Hypothetically speaking, there are ways to run, you know, businesses so that you do not run afoul of UPL. They may have very good legal advisors that have told them, you know, what to say and what not to say. It concerns me. I wouldn't say it's, you know, for sure, no, you can't do that. But it's an interesting question. Anybody else? Well, you only need 50 minutes for Ethics Daily New York, and we have done 55, so you are all now more than entitled to your elusive ethics credit. I'm happy to stick around for a little while in case anyone has other questions. So thank you for listening.